Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby.
And together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in on Season 3! We were talking about this before we started recording, yes. But when we first started talking about this show, Teddy was like a baby. And now Penny is a baby. And Teddy's like running around and like a little tiny person now.
He's about to be 3. It's wild.
Yeah, lots has changed in the time since we've been on here. I don't have the same boyfriend. You don't have the same house. And you...
Life moves fast.
Life does move fast. And right after we wrapped season 2, you had your daughter. How is she?
Oh, she's great. We're both doing great. I had a really, like, a surprisingly quick delivery. Mm-hmm. It was so quick that, like, my husband and I both looked at each other when she was born and we were like, wow, like... there's no way that just happened. It was so surreal, but it was really good. And she was healthy and we recovered really quickly. So it was really great.
That's so great. And you bought a house.
Yes, that was so wild. We've kind of been thinking about buying a house for a while now, but we wanted one in the tiny town that we live. And it's like a very small town. So it's kind of like hard to see when a house goes on sale. And this was the funniest story. My father-in-law was on vacation with some friends and they were snowed in. And so they looked at like the local newspaper. Someone had it with them, and not even under the real estate category, but just under like random things to sell, there was a house listed. No picture, no nothing. It was just house for sale and then our town's name. And he sent it over and was like, hey, you might want to check that out. And I called the lady. And I was like, hi, we're interested. She was like, this house was built in 1964, expanded in 79. I was like, oh, this sounds really
great. And your eyes just lit up and you were like, this is my dream.
Yes, this is it. And also just the location and everything sounded really great. So we went over the next day and we were so in love that we were kind of like telling them, well, we'll let you know by tomorrow. We left, got in the car, looked at each other. We're like, we want this house. We called them. 10 minutes later, we're like, we don't have to think through this. We're going to get the house.
Oh, I'm and it's really so great. Happy for you guys.
It's been such a fun thing.
And the move has been a little crazy, but like, I know you love a project. You love a DIY. Yes. So like, after all the heavy duty stuff is done, are you so excited to like... do all the painting and the wallpapers and get all the furniture set.
I am so excited because the one thing that isn't perfect about this house is that the wiring is also from 1964. So it's a little bit of a fire hazard. So we're having people come next week and basically tear open all walls and put new wiring in so that it's just up to safety standard, and then we'll be able to wallpaper and paint and do all the fun things. Because so far I was only able to do my office because that's the expansion that was built later, so that already has the new wiring. But I am so excited. I have stacks of wallpaper in my basement. It looks like I'm running a shop.
It's so you to get the office done first.
But we actually have something very, very special for our season back. We wanted to kick off the season with a special guest. And we were kind of reaching for the stars here. But I just decided to be brave.
You organized all of this.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have dared if you wouldn't have encouraged me to. Because I ended up writing an email to the Jenny Boyd and just asked her to be a guest. And she said yes. And it was our communal dream come true.
Thank you so much for getting this for us. I can't wait to see. We're recording this before everything comes together. Yes. So I can't wait to see how this episode sort of comes together.
Yeah, me either, because our interview with her was so great. Like, I was beaming the day after. It filled me with so much joy to just hear her talk about life. It was such a special experience.
She's a really nice lady.
Yes.
We wanted to start this new season with a very special guest. This woman's book has been on both of our reading lists for a while. We both own a copy, both read our copies. It was such a phenomenal read, and we are so excited to welcome Jenny Boyd on the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
When Jenny Boyd was invited by George Harrison and her sister Patty to travel to India with the Beatles, she asked, "How can I ever repay you? Just be yourself," George told her. And being herself took Jenny on an incredible journey through the 1960s rock and fashion scene. As a model in swinging London and the younger sister of Patty Boyd, she had just the right look for the time. As a friend and muse to music legends, she inspired Donovan's 1968 hit Jennifer Juniper, traveled to San Francisco during the Summer of Love, and later married and married again Fleetwood Mac drummer Mick Fleetwood. But her story is more than the famous men around her. It's about a woman, a daughter, a sister, and mother who went on a journey beyond anything she could have ever dreamed of.
Helen Mary Boyd was born on November 1st, 1947 in Surrey, England. Her name is not actually Jennifer. That was a nickname given to her by her older sister, Patty. Her father, Colin Jock Boyd, had been a Royal Air Force pilot, and her mother, Diana, was a former beauty queen. When they met, Jock was an outgoing and charismatic man, and they fell in love very quickly, even though Jock was about to go to war. While serving, he was in a horrible accident that left him both physically and emotionally scarred. "Before their marriage, my mother had only known him superficially," Jenny explained, "a dashing young man, handsome in his RAF uniform, who had taken her in his arms and rolled her around the dance floor. Her romantic dreams had been wasted away by the man she'd fallen in love with, now replaced by a disfigured and traumatized husband, in need of a much more mature woman to look after him." Diana did later admit that they'd gotten married way too young. Jenny had two older siblings, Patty and Colin, and a younger sister named Paula. When Jenny was just 9 months old, the family moved to colonial Kenya in East Africa, where her father hoped to find a good job. The Boyds had very little money, and Kenya didn't bring them the new beginning they'd hoped for. By the time Jenny was 5, her parents had divorced, and Diana met a new man. His name was Bobby, a 27-year-old military man now working for a rubber company. He showered the kids with gifts at first, but it soon became apparent that Bobby was ill-prepared for a life with 4 kids. It wasn't what he'd imagined. Quote, "Not long after their wedding, Bobby and my mother left for England on board the SS Kenya, taking 2-year-old Paula with them. It was arranged that we older children would join them one by one later that year. We never questioned the reason for this, but now, as an adult, I presume it would have been too disruptive to the new marriage to include 4 children. By this time, Patty felt almost like a mother to me, although she was only 9 years old. She and my brother were sent to boarding school in Nakuru, while I went to kindergarten. Suddenly, an only child, looked after by my nanny and occasionally getting a glimpse of my father." A couple years later, Jenny joined her mother and stepfather in London, where they were now living. Bobby, once the charming man, had started to show his true colors. He had a bad temper that he often took out on the children. He would pit them against each other and tried to come between the bond they had formed. But he underestimated just how close the siblings were, especially Jenny and Patty. While Bobby tried to portray Patty as the bad girl, the meddler, and Jenny as the good one, trying to get her to tell on her sister, it didn't work. Their bond only grew closer.
Despite the chaos at home, Jenny grew up a thoughtful, imaginative girl. As a teenager, she watched her big sister Patty launch a glamorous and adventurous career as a fashion model. Patty's success made an impression on Jenny. By her mid-teens, Jenny too was strikingly pretty, slender, with the big eyes and baby-faced look that defined the Dolly Bird era. Jenny was still in school when one day in the early 1960s, she met the man she would marry. Quote, "I was first introduced to Mick
by a sculpture Dale, a friend from school, had made. She slapped her books on the desk, sat down, and then brought out of her bag a small figurine made of thin copper wire. As the teacher began talking, she adjusted this piece of sculpture and set it on the edge of her desk with its long legs dangling over the side. "Who is it?" I whispered. "It's this boy called Mig, who's gorgeous," she replied. "He's got long hair and got long legs and plays in a group called the Chains. Come with me and meet him," Dale whispered as she bent down, pretending to look for something in her bag. "I'm going to his bed after school with some grapes. He's got flu." I was later to find out that 16-year-old Mick Fleetwood was only 6 months older than me, but had left school and his home in Salisbury the previous year, filled with dreams of living in London and becoming a drummer. I met Dale at the coffee mill on this particular Saturday afternoon, and that was where I first officially met Mick Fleetwood. He walked into the cafe with one of the band's members, who was also his roommate, Roger. Mick was tall, skinny, with brown shoulder-length poker-straight hair, which was parted on the side and hid most of his pale, narrow face. When he did sweep his curtain of hair aside, the most enormous eyes looked directly at me before taking another sip of his hot chocolate. He appeared very gentle and soft-spoken. Although Jenny was interested in Mick from the very beginning, she first started going out with his room and bandmate Roger. She would see Mick every now and then, and the two would glance at each other in passing. But her relationship with Roger was what gave her the push to start her career. Roger had gotten the job of redecorating Foyle and Tuffin's new showroom in Carnaby Street, and while he was there, they had told him they were looking for a house model. He had suggested Jenny. It had never occurred to me to become a model, but as arranged, I went with him a few days later to meet Sally Tuffin and Marion Fole. Later, Roger made fun of the way Jenny conducted the interview, telling her that she hadn't spoken loud enough and giving confusion answers. And so, I didn't think for a minute I had the job and made my way back to school, ready to continue my education with the thought of one day becoming a journalist. Those plans came to an abrupt halt the following evening, when Marion Foley called me to offer me the job. She told me I would be expected to model their latest designs in their showroom for the fashion editors from Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Queen, Elle, and all the other glossy magazines. I would also be expected to help in the office when they didn't need me to model and to serve customers in the boutique they were soon to open. I would be paid £5 a week after tax. I was thrilled. Without a moment hesitation, I took the job. I left school at the end of the week without even discussing this new turn of events with my mother. The following Monday, I caught the train to Carnaby Street and arrived at the Fole and Tuffin office at 9 a.m., ready to see where this might lead.
Well, let's kick things right off, because pretty early in your memoir, Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse, you write about your modeling career that comes pretty early in the book as sort of being a fixture of the 60s London scene. So what did your typical workday as a model look like?
Well, it depended. So for quite some time, I had this huge portfolio with all these different photographs that photographers had taken, jobs I'd done. And what you had to do, which I think is probably very different nowadays, you had to trail that thing along, because they were pretty heavy, and go and visit, you know, either newspapers or magazines or different photographers. So it was, you know, quite a lot of pounding the pavement.
Right.
And then I had an agent, so then I'd be told what I was doing and what I needed to bring. And, you know, often I'd forget things, like sometimes I remember being on a job and I only had one eyelashes to put on, you know, just things like that. So although I took it seriously in many ways, there was also a lightheartedness about it. And so, you know, maybe one day I'd be told, okay, you've got to meet at this particular place and you're going to be doing summer wear. And it could be in the middle of winter and it's freezing and you've got to wear these little summer things and skip around. Yeah, a lot of the time also I was asked to, whereas I once did the catwalk, and that was in New York, and I thought it was horrible. Just, I didn't like it at all. Apart from that, I was very nearsighted, so I couldn't see the end of the runway. But I loved the music. That always was great. So from then on, when I'd be asked to do catwalks along railway stations in Brussels or, you know, different parts of the world, I just danced. And I just couldn't help myself, you know, that was what music did for me. So I became known as the one that sort of would dance rather than be having learnt how to walk properly and be very grown up. And I just brought another aspect of it to the scene.
It's something different every day, right?
Yeah, and it could be like a little, I didn't do that many, but I did do a couple of commercials. And I did do something that was, I guess you would, it was a film, but it's not a, like a full length feature film. It would be probably somebody, some cameraman who's wanting to show it at the film festival in France. But so I did some of those, which is quite fun.
So cool.
It was quite varied.
In mid-60s swinging London, Jenny found her career taking off. Soon she was an in-demand model, posing for magazines and catalogs. She also got to work alongside her sister on a few photo shoots, with Jenny sometimes tagging along to Patty's assignments. Traditional runway modeling, though, unnerved her. Quote, "When I had to do the straight catwalk, it was terrifying. It didn't feel like me at all." So Jenny improvised and made the experience her own. Instead of a stiff, proper runway walk, she danced her way down the catwalk. Fashion shows in London often played upbeat Motown and R&B music, and Jenny couldn't help but sway to the beat. Beyond the world of fashion, the Boyd sisters were also socializing in the same circles as Britain's rock royalty. When Patty began dating George Harrison in 1964, Jenny suddenly had a direct line into the Beatles' inner world. Patty and George married in 1966, and through them, Jenny met the other Beatles and their friends, folks like Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, and more.
I always wondered, also when reading your book, did it feel like you were making history? Did it feel like that was kind of like a time that would be so influential in the way that we now see art and film and fashion?
Yeah, not at all. Because you're young then, you know, you're 17, maybe even 18, but you're still young and you're just, the world is very exciting. And you don't think, gosh, you know, this isn't what normal people do or people my age or anything. It was just that you never knew what was going to happen next. And that, you don't.
Yeah.
So it was very carefree. In many ways.
Quote, "A short time later, as I sat in the new Fole & Tuffin shop putting records on the turntables and serving customers, I looked out the window, and to my surprise, there was Mick standing on the pavement, looking up at the Fole & Tuffin sign above the shop. His hair had been cut in the same Vidal Sassoon shape that was so fashionable, and for the first time I could see his face. He stood with a couple of friends, looking very stylish in a long white cardigan and black flares. I walked outside and was introduced to members of the new group. He recently joined the Bow Street Runners. As the others waved goodbye and drifted off, Mick followed me into the shop. We hadn't seen each other for a few months, and by this time he and Roger had moved into separate flats. I felt very happy to see him. His gentle ways were like cool running water compared to the dark, brooding quality of Roger. He stayed with me for the rest of the afternoon while I served customers. Little did I know then how pivotal this reconnection was to be. It was the beginning of a long and at times painful journey we were destined to embark on together." They didn't exchange phone numbers, though, and Jenny was wondering if she would see him again for a while, but just a couple days later, he came back to the shop. "Sometimes it is the first kiss one remembers that seals the new relationship," Jenny said, "or maybe one doesn't remember what happened when. But for me, what sticks in my memory is the first time Mick held my hand. We were in Notting Hill Gate, about to cross the road, when he did something that felt perfectly natural. Without looking at me, he held his hand out behind his back. I remember putting my hand in his for the first time, feeling the gentle contact of our skin together as we crossed the road and onto our destination."
On March 7, 1967, Jenny arrived in San Francisco ahead of the Summer of Love. She had never heard of Haight Ashbury before or of the hippies. She didn't know that just a couple weeks before she arrived, Timothy Leary had stood up and told a crowd of thousands at the Human Being to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Jenny was staying with her friend Judy Wong in the heart of the American counterculture. Quote, "I wrote letters to Patty and George telling them about this feeling of utopia I had experienced walking along Haight Ashbury. The creative people, a wonderful music, the feelings of love and free love from everyone, and the free style of living."
From sort of your earlier answers, you know, the music and the music is really a great fixture for you.
Yeah.
So yeah. Like, what records were you buying at this time? What did you own and love?
Gosh. Well, where did we... I would go when I was in San Francisco, I'd go to bands. I wouldn't listen to the radio, listen to music. It wasn't like that. You know, because they had all these San Francisco bands and they'd play and they didn't charge anything and they'd be in the park or, you know, just I listened to music that way. Because I don't really remember, you know, and or if we'd go to clubs and you'd have all the latest Tamla Motown that we couldn't get in England. So I loved, you know, I loved all the music, but I don't really remember when I was younger I would buy records. Yeah, I suppose they must have had like all these great radio stations too.
She got a job working at Judy's boutique, Passion Flower, and enjoyed experiencing the heart of 1960s San Francisco. One evening, she got a call. Patty and George had made it to San Francisco. Jenny was so excited to see them, and especially Patty. And when they left a week later and Jenny's visa was running out, she decided to come back to England with them. I love the pictures of Patty and George at Haight-Ashbury. The fashion and everything is so stunning. And I have to be honest, until I read her memoir, I did not know that they were there to visit her.
Yeah. Was there anything else from, you know, the 60s and the 70s that you wish you'd held on to? Like, oh, I wish I still had that jacket or, oh, that album that I loved.
Well, because I was Fole & Tuffin's house model, all their clothes were made for me. And they were pantsuits, you know, when they, before that was even anywhere near, people weren't wearing them. And I loved them and I loved all their clothes. They were just like perfect. And I just connected with them, all of them. And when I went to San Francisco, and I took them because it was almost like, well, I didn't have an apartment where I just leave some things there or anyone I could leave them with. So I just took everything in a big suitcase and, you know, I was there for the 6 months. But then when I left, that's when Patty and George and a few of the others came over and sort of said, okay, did the famous walk along Haight-Ashbury, but then said, okay, now we're taking you back home. Because your 6 months is up. So I just, all I had time for was to get my passport. So I had to leave all those lovely Fole and Tuffin clothes that I loved. I had to leave them all behind and never saw them again.
By late 1967, Jenny was back in London and straight into another adventure with the Beatles. In December of the same year, the Beatles opened their own short-lived retail venture, the Apple Boutique in London. The shop was an eclectic psychedelic bazaar on Baker Street, selling clothes, jewelry, and assorted trippy curios, all designed and curated by the colorful design collective The Fool, who also painted its vivid mural facade. If this sounds familiar to you, it is because previous doll Marijke Kroeger was part of The Fool. When the Beatles asked Jenny to work at the Apple Boutique, it seemed like the perfect fit. She handled sales and helped manage the inventory, all while wearing the dreamy designs herself. The atmosphere at Apple was as psychedelic as one could imagine. Walls painted in swirling day-glow murals, staff and customers decked in velvet and paisley, and a general spirit of idealism. There's a particularly dreamy picture of Jenny with Patty, Cynthia Lennon, and Maureen Starkey modeling the clothes, looking like psychedelic goddesses.
You also worked in on the different side of fashion when working and managing the Apple Boutique. And we were wondering what that was like because that was a whole new role for you. And it's honestly a shop that Abby and I would both die to shop at.
I'd just come back from San Francisco, so I'd had my 6 months in San Francisco and got very much immersed in that counterculture. And I was searching, you know, I was searching, and I think I wasn't quite sure what I was searching for, but I think it was something like something more than just the everyday, like just I don't know. I don't particularly like the word, but like a higher power, you know, that sort of, I was looking for something greater than what our everyday existence is. So there was a purpose, and I think I was looking for that purpose, but I didn't know. I just knew I was looking for something, and it was only when we went to India that I felt this is it. This is what I'd been looking for, you know, this sort of sense of when you meditate, just this feeling of oneness, and yeah, I think we were there for about 3 months, and that's because it was very, although it was very Dolly Bird and all that sort of stuff, there was another part that was starting to emerge, which was, what's it all about? And I think I must have only been 18, 19. But I knew that there was something more than how we're living.
The Apple Boutique store was just amazing. You got to like wear the clothes as you sold the clothes, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. And also, because I'd just come from San Francisco and it had all been like in those head shops and down Haight-Ashbury, and you'd see all the sort of Indian gods and goddesses, posters of them. And so that's what they replicated in the Apple store. So as well as the clothes by Simona Marijke, they had all this sort of stuff from India, which is what was going on in San Francisco. And so I was often the one that would be sought after to give an interview to any of the newspapers, because it was like, oh, what is this? Because, you know, London in those days was black and white. And here was this building for a start in a very traditional place. And, you know, the rainbow colours going up. This was big. And you'd see these everyday people in their grey coats and this and that, and little old ladies and stuff looking inside in wonder at what's going on. Suddenly, it was full of colour. And all the clothes were full of colour. And they were sort of daring to be and do anything and, you know, create a fashion that is completely a fantasy. And so that was, and there's a lovely photograph actually of Patty and Cynthia Lennon and Maureen Starkey and me. And yeah, it was the Sunday Times, and it was by, I'm trying to think of the photographer's name, but, and we're in their clothes. It was, and it's lovely. It's just, it was like looking at the world very differently.
Quote, I rented a room in a large Victorian flat a few minutes walk from Baker Street with Mick Fleetwood, John Dominic, and two other boys. Mick and I had seen each other periodically after our breakup. He would sometimes take me out for a drive in his old Alvis, and we'd spend the day chatting about our different lives. It always left me wondering whether we should get back together. He seemed so sweet and gentle, so safe after navigating my way through such unsettled waters. The guys teased him unmercifully once I moved in, knowing he still held a flame for me. I was standing behind the shop counter in the basement one day, cup of tea in hand and chatting with a friend, when I heard the clumping and creaking sound of footsteps traipsing down the stairs. An imp face with dark curly hair popped out from around the corner. As his foot touched the bottom step, his face lit up. Jenny, he exclaimed with his eyes wide open. I didn't know you work here. It was Donovan, England's answer to Bob Dylan. He told her that he was taking the train down to Cornwall to be photographed for his new album and that he would love for Jenny to be in the photos. Jenny was thrilled and they arranged to meet at the train station. The photographs were taken by Carl Ferris for Donovan's album, A Gift from a Flower to a Garden. For Jenny, Donovan was a poet. Quote, the way he spoke, his beautiful lyrics about folklore and fairy tale, everything he did conjured up another world, a world of childlike innocence that, as the day went by, we recognized in each other. He stood in front of the sea, wearing a black embroidered cape with beads around his neck and flowers in his hair, while I sat on a rock, my long blonde hair blowing in the wind, playing a wooden flute. Carl videoed us while we played like children in the sand, dressed in our velvet clothes and colored chip of scarves as we skipped along the dunes, looking into caves, along with a young boy in green who looked like a pixie.
In your book, you very briefly mention a photo shoot with Carl Ferris and Donovan for his A Gift from a Flower to a Garden album. You're in the Where Your Love Like Heaven film. So what do you remember of making that short, sort of that shoot day?
It was taking the train to Cornwall, and that's quite a long journey. But because I loved the whole kind of fairy world, and I was very one of those kind of, I don't know, definitely suited Donovan, you know, and what he wanted to portray. And so he comes along on his horse, doesn't he, on his white horse.
Yes.
And his singing and his voice, everything goes along with it. And so it was like we were allowed to be children, and we were allowed to dress up in anything we wanted and play in this imaginary world.
For a long time, the both of us, Emma and I, have sort of coveted this outfit that you're wearing in the film, this sort of vibrant psychedelic dress and this red velvet cape. The dress belonged to your sister, Patty, yes?
It might have done, yeah. I'll have to have a look at it. I haven't had a look at it for a while.
Right. Did the cape belong to you, or did you borrow that from someone?
I think that must have been borrowed.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there was that little guy there, you know, all in green, like a little elf.
Yes, Gypsy Dave.
Yeah.
No, it was a little kid.
Oh!
He was about, looked like he was about 12 years old, and I don't know whether he was meant to be part of it or not. It was just like, where did he come from? And, yeah. But it was sweet, you know, it was very fantasy.
A couple days later, Donovan went back to the store and invited Jenny to spend a day with him at his manager's house in the country after lunch. Donovan took her aside and told her that he had written a song for her. He began singing Jennifer Junifer. I thought it was the prettiest song I've ever heard. I loved the sound of his acoustic guitar and his gentle voice. He reminded me of a troubadour or minstrel from days of old of court, love, and chivalry. As I listened closely to the words, is she breathing? Yes, very low. I know it was about me meditating, but as it got closer to the end, I'm thinking what it would be like if she loved me. I realized it was a declaration of his love. Luckily, as the lyrics changed from English to French, I had the chance, not understanding a word, to look up and smile at him. But inside, I knew this song could take our friendship into another level, and I wasn't ready. Jenny and Donovan ended up seeing each other over the next couple of weeks, but they never started a relationship. Jenny felt as though she was internally married to Mick. Jennifer Juniper, released in early 1968, became a top 5 hit in the UK, forever linking Jenny's name to the Summer of Love era. Jennifer Juniper lives upon the hill. Jennifer Juniper sitting very still. Is she sleeping? Don't think so. Is she breathing? Yes, very low. What you do when Jennifer, my love?
In early 1968, as winter turned to spring, Jenny received an extraordinary invitation. Her sister Patty and her brother-in-law George were traveling to India, and they asked Jenny to come along. I was stunned, taken by surprise in my wildest dreams, Jenny remembers. I did not imagine that I would be included in this trip. I was delighted at the thought of going there with Patty and George, and felt that they, more than anyone I knew, understood the spiritual path that I was so earnestly seeking. She began her spiritual journey in San Francisco. How can I ever repay you? Jenny asked. Just be yourself, George replied, quote, and that's it. I realized many years later that's all we ever have to do, but at that time it felt out of touch with myself. And maybe Patty and George had sensed that, because we were all on this spiritual path together. He wanted to include me on this journey. The Beatles were heading to Rishikesh to study transcendental meditation under the Maharishi. Jenny, still very much a spiritual seeker, jumped at the chance. She'd been interested in meditation before, and this trip seemed to be the answer to all her questions. In February, she joined Patty, George, John and his wife Cynthia, Paul McCartney and his girlfriend Jane Asher, Ringo and his wife Maureen, Donovan, Beach Boy Mike Love, and a whole other cast of characters on the journey to the Maharishi's ashram in the Himalayan foothills.
But going to India, I had always wanted to go to India, and I don't know, because our mother was born in India and then came over to England when she was about 7, had to go to boarding school. But her parents lived in India, her grandparents lived in India, so there was a real history of India. And so when we first went, and there was Patty, George, and me, and we were in the car driving from Delhi to where the ashram was. And I remember thinking, I feel like I've been here before. You know, it was a real deja vu. And I remember telling George about that, and he said, oh yeah, you know, he feels that. Just, there was just something about it that was very familiar. And then when you're in the ashram, you're taken care of, really. And, you know, the fact that Himalayas are there and the Ganges is just down below. And it was like being in heaven.
Life at the ashram was idyllic. Days were spent meditating and listening to the Maharishi's lectures amid the lush peace of the Ganges riverside. The Beatles were writing songs that would later become the White Album. Jenny adored spending time at the ashram. but the bliss didn't last. After a few weeks, rumors spread of inappropriate behavior by the Maharishi towards the female attendees. A dramatic exodus followed. The Beatles, John and George, Ringo and Paul had already left India, abruptly left in anger, with Jenny and Patty doing the same. Later, it's been suggested that the scandal may have been stirred up by Magic Alex, an associate of the Beatles and shameless grifter, who was jealous of the Maharishi's influence. But I don't think we'll ever truly know what happened in India. In her book, Jenny writes that she felt as though Magic Alex wanted the Beatles to follow him, the guru, and not the Maharishi as their guru. And so after spending some time with Ravi Shankar, they arrived back in England, her, Patty, and George. Through all of Jenny's adventures in the late 60s, Mick Fleetwood had never left her thoughts, even as his own career was taking off. By 1969, the soft-spoken schoolboy Jenny once knew and had fallen for was now a budding rock star. While Jenny was in San Francisco, Mick Fleetwood had co-founded the band Fleetwood Mac. And by the late 60s, they were a top British blues rock act. This was the Fleetwood Mac long before the pop Fleetwood Mac. In 1968, Jenny and Patty set up a stall, selling Art Nouveau and antique pieces. It was a little booth in the alley of the Chelsea Antique Market and King's Road, and they named their stall Juniper, after the song. Quote, "A letter from Mick Fleetwood addressed to me in care of the antique market arrived one day." It's so cute that he addressed it to her store.
Yes.
Because he knew where she'd be. Fleetwood Mac were on their first tour of the States after the great success of their single Albatross, which went to number one in the British charts. In this letter, he asked me to marry him, which took me by surprise. The thought of marriage had never occurred to me. I had not seen him since before I went to India, and we lived in such different worlds. Although I felt moved and flattered by his proposal, I figured it had arrived too late. I was too immersed in my own world of friends and like-minded seekers. By this time, Jenny was dating a man named Martin, but he was feeling that she still had feelings for Mick, especially after the two started seeing each other regularly again. She told Martin she didn't want to live with him and be with him anymore, and drove to Devon to stay with her mother. Quote, "I was sitting in an armchair, reading in the room that overlooks the garden, and my mother opened the door and said, 'Martin's here to see you,' and then disappeared. I stood up, walked towards the door, and there was Martin with his frizzy hair and pale face. Our eyes met as we stood facing each other, and then without saying a word, he slapped me hard across the face. I stared at him in shock, my face burning, stinging like tiny pinpricks where his hand had been, making my eyes water. Only once had I ever been slapped across the face before, and that was by my mother when I was a teenager. No boyfriend had ever slapped me, except for this man, the self-proclaimed hippie who was living the gentle life with a bubbling fury beyond words. Only he struck me. I didn't move. All I could think of saying was, 'I hope you feel better now.'"
She arranged to meet Mick later that week. Quote, "I accept your offer, Mick," I said, my stomach churning, my body shaking, and my eyes watering. "I want to be with you." As I spoke these words, I felt as though I'd finally come home. The relief was all encompassing, knowing that this was the man I wanted to spend my life with. Mick took my hand, tears in his eyes, and nodded. After years of dating on and off, Mick and Jenny decided to truly commit. In June 1970, at age 22, Jenny Boyd married Mick Fleetwood. The wedding was a modest affair, certainly compared to the fanfare of Patty's marriage to a Beatle a few years prior, although she had also chosen a more private ceremony. In fact, even on his wedding day, Mick seemed a bit distracted. Jenny later wrote that at the ceremony, Mick appeared to be in a world of his own, his thoughts already on the band's troubles. Their lead guitarist, Peter Green, had abruptly quit Fleetwood Mac that spring. Jenny loved Mick, but she was about to discover the hard truth of being married to a dedicated musician. If you're going to be with someone who's clearly an artist, who's deeply dedicated to what they do, then you need something that you're passionate about for yourself. Otherwise, you're just an extension of someone else's dream, she reflected later. At the time, Jenny hadn't found that something of her own yet.
That's the thing with being a musician. They are married to the band first.
I thought that that was so interesting because I read about especially the Rolling Stones being so
hardcore musicians, I want to say, because in three books I've read so far, Uschi Obermeier, I think even the Pamela the Bar one possibly, but especially the Marian Faithful one and the Anita one, they all make a point to say that for the Stones, it was music, music, and music. And women came far behind that.
Yes. Being in a band is a very insular world.
Because I think you're also, it becomes such a big part of your identity. It's not like a job compared to being, I don't want to say that like another job cannot take your entire personality, but I feel like for musicians, very, very hard to be someone else outside of being a musician almost.
Yes, it's easy to consume, and Jenny writes about that.
Right after Tying the Knot, the Fleetwood's domestic life took an unconventional turn. Mick was desperate to keep his fragile band together in the wake of Peter Green's departure. His solution? Move the whole band into one house, and with him and Jenny. So the newlyweds found themselves living communally with Fleetwood Mac's remaining members in a house named Benefolds.
I believe this was the first of two attempts at communal living by Fleetwood Mac. Their second try was in Headley Grange.
Yes, and both did not go well.
If you're a Led Zeppelin fan, you will know what Headley Grange was.
I mean, I feel like for Fleetwood Mac especially, there are a lot of jokes about how this band was like crazily intertwined and everyone was with everyone. But I do have to say, for me, it's a wild thought to move in with the people that you're already working with, because I would feel like I need a break. Like, even the people I love the most, I love to have a moment for myself.
Yeah, and you don't work with those people. Like, your husband isn't working on your videos and you're not going to work with him. It's very separate.
No.
I think it's very important to have separate things.
My husband does not use social media, so we live in very different worlds. During this period, Jenny even contributed creatively to the band. She penned the lyrics to one Fleetwood Mac song, Purple Dancer, and part of another, Jeweled Eyed Judy.
I love the purple dancer, dancing in the space of time. She can surely know the answer, standing in the steps of
But when the record came out, Jenny's name was nowhere in the songwriting credits. The band's manager had deliberately credited the song to Mick and the other male members instead, reportedly unwilling to acknowledge a band member's wife as a writer. Jenny was taken aback. It was a bitter reminder that, to the outside world, she was viewed as merely a drummer's wife, not a creative contributor. Quote, in the winter of 1970, when I was 7 months pregnant, we all moved into Benefolds, Mick and I, John and Chris, Jeremy and his wife Fiona and their two small children. Danny and his girlfriend lived there during rehearsals and recording while the road crew crashed out on any beds they could find on the third floor. We divided the house into three parts. Mick and I had one side of the sweeping staircase and the downstairs scullery to a kitchen. Chris and John had rooms on the other side of the house, separated by a swing door. I felt rather self-conscious with John and Chris, who seemed very grown up as a couple. Chris would make delicious meals in her little kitchen, and John was always there with her, creating a warm and welcoming atmosphere. Chris was definitely like one of the boys.
Chris being Christine McVie.
Yes.
Quote, in the second week of January 1971, the band was touring in Scotland when Mick got a call from the hospital to tell him I had gone into labor and things were not going well. He was told that both my life and the baby's were in danger and he should come down to Basingstoke immediately. I remember lying on a bed in an operating room after being in labor for what felt like days, holding the hands of two doctors on either side of me and feeling decidedly relaxed. In that mist, my mother appeared, as if from nowhere, a worried, anxious look on her face. I felt so peaceful and couldn't understand what she was doing there. "It'll be all right, don't worry," she said, her face full of fear. I smiled at her as if in a dream while they ushered her out the door. In the waiting room, she told Patty and Paula to go home and forget the flowers. Soon afterwards, the doctor did an emergency cesarean, which was something quite rare in those days. Jenny's daughter, Amelia, was born healthy, and both were soon able to go home.
This is a podcast, obviously, about the women of the 1960s and 70s, because we felt like a lot of the stories that we know about those times are told through men's eyes. That's why we also adored reading your book. It's just a different perspective. And we were just wondering, or I was wondering, what was kind of like the most important lesson you learned from being a mother?
Wow. How to really love, I think. How to really love, like deep love. And protect.
In your book, you're quite open about the fact that you had a more difficult relationship with your own mother. But is there something that you feel like she taught you or something that you do that reminds you of her?
Yeah, she loved beauty. She was quite artistic. And she loved beautiful, beautiful things. I'm not sure if her life was particularly happy. I think she had problems with men. Our father was, that was not great. Because you read about that in the book. And then her second husband, you know, he went off with the next door neighbor. And I think she, it must have been quite tough for her. And then trying to bring up children as well as that.
I think it was just beautiful from your book that you got to tell not only your story, but also a part of your mom's story, because it is so interesting how you had so much more freedom than she had in your life. And I found that really interesting. We talk a lot on this show about being a working woman in the 1960s and 70s when there was still the expectation to get married and start a family. Did you ever feel pressure to choose between a career and a family?
No, no. Everything just opened up. So I just took each day as it came. And, you know, then I was going out with Mick Fleetwood, and he was young and he had, you know, the band that he was in. And I would just continue every time I was told, okay, you've got this job or you've got that job, I would go and do it. So the only thing that's a little bit like that is that, let's see, so it would have been probably just the end of the 60s when Mick and I got back together again. And then I'd stopped modelling, and I'd been asked by the woman who was the editor of Vogue magazine, who I obviously knew quite well because of all the work I'd done with them. And she said, would you like a job and working at Vogue, at the office? And I wanted to do that. But then Mick said, no, I want you here so that you can come on the road when I'm on the road.
Did you feel like that was cool to go on the road? Because that seems like such a dream. It seems so much cooler than working in an office, but did it feel like that for you too?
No, because I think there was a part of me that was very independent, that had been used to working myself, you know, even though it was modelling or doing whatever I was doing. But no, because I didn't really like going on the road, because because nobody had any money in those days, is that you'd be at a venue, and then it would always be about the band, and then they'd have sound check, and then they'd do this, and then they would have supper backstage. So one had no self-expression yourself. You're just there to be there. And when we had children, then it was more difficult, because then with my first daughter, and she was really small when we went out on the road, I remember being in New York, and I'd have to get up really early because, say, Mick and the rest of the band had gone to bed late, and I'd have to wheel her around the streets of New York until, say, maybe some shops opened, or, you know, so it was quite tough in a way.
Life on the road with Fleetwood Mac soon got busier, and Mick was often gone for weeks or months at a time. The absence was painful, and it was the beginning of their marital strains. Over the next few years, Mick's ambition exploded along with the band's workload. They were constantly recording, performing, and chasing success, first in the UK, and by 1974, relocating to Los Angeles for the first time in a bid to finally crack the American market. Jenny, meanwhile, often found herself home alone, caring for their growing family. A second daughter, Amy, was born in 1973. A pattern began to emerge when Mick was on tour with the rest of the band, Jenny explained. I felt lonely and frightened, knowing that it was only the baby and me in this big old house. Gradually, it became a way of life, albeit a lonely one, and I carved out an existence of normalcy and routine. When Mick came home, usually after 3 months, the house filled up with the band and road crew. My space, as large as it was, felt encroached upon. They had all returned from a different world, one that was secluded and protected from reality, getting through the 3 months however best they could. Through one kind of trauma or another, they would become even more tightly knit, having each other's shoulders to cry on or rally around, just the kind of bond I longed for. If one strayed from the straight and narrow, the rest of the band would say nothing to the spouse or girlfriend at home, so when they returned, it was always a them-against-me feeling, with no idea what world they had inhabited for the past 3 months. Communication between husband and wife deteriorated. "Even when we were together, we barely communicated," Jenny said of those years. She was proud of Mick's dedication and loved him deeply, but she felt increasingly isolated and insecure. By late 1973, the isolation had pushed Jenny away. Feeling neglected and unloved, she began an affair with one of Fleetwood Mac's guitarists, Bob Weston. Bob was a friendly, attentive presence, giving Jenny the understanding and affection she craved. But the affair, once discovered, detonated an enormous crisis that was already brewing. Mick was furious when he found out about Jenny and Bob. He promptly fired Weston from the band mid-tour in 1973, which caused the remaining Fleetwood Mac members to literally abandon the tour. This broke up the whole lineup of this band. A notorious episode where a fake Fleetwood Mac was sent out by their manager to fulfill concert dates also transpired, triggering a litany of legal problems.
Can you imagine buying tickets to see Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, I've heard about this before with the Zombies, because they had broken up right after they completed Odyssey and Oracle, and then Time of the Season was a hit like 6 months later. So you had sort of fake Zombies cropping up in America, but I think the fake Fleetwood Mac is one of the most famous examples of this.
Yes.
Like now, Fleetwood Mac being what it is now, I don't think you could ever imagine this happening. But when the music press was really different, you only had like a couple photos in a magazine every once in a while to go across. You don't have social media, so you know what these guys look like. It was a lot easier to pull something crazy like this off.
I feel like you only needed a couple of people who vaguely look like Fleetwood Mac and who were kind of able to play an instrument, and that would have worked. But I do wonder if someone was in the crowd and was like, I kind of figured they sounded and looked a little different, but okay. I mean, if people tell you that's them, maybe you just buy it. I don't know.
Oh gosh. Jenny, overcome with guilt, ended the affair with Bob and returned to Mick, trying to repair their marriage. "The affair I had, I felt so guilty about it," she said later. "It took me many years to get over it because it was so against my nature."
The mid-1970s pushed Jenny to a breaking point. Both Mick and Jenny were abusing alcohol and drugs heavily by then. Their home life was volatile. Jenny would leave Mick in anger, even taking the children with her, only to reconcile under family pressure. Jenny felt utterly alone and unsupported. Seeking refuge, she stayed for a while with her sister, Patty, who by then was married to Eric Clapton. But that situation turned out of the frying pan into the fire. Eric was in the depths of alcoholism himself and became verbally abusive. In a shocking incident, a drunk Eric crawled into Jenny's bed one night while Patty was asleep elsewhere in the house. Jenny fled that scenario as well. After Patty explained that Eric's twisted jealousy fueled his behavior, he wanted to separate the sisters by sowing discord.
Tick another box of Eric Clapton doing something insane on this show.
Yep. We could do a best of episode of just...
Worst of.
Worst of Eric Clapton.
So you did a lot of traveling in a pretty short amount of time in London and San Francisco and then back in England and over into India as well. And through all of your travels, even in living in America, you've always been close with your sister Patty, even when you've lived in different countries. How do you stay close with a sister in adulthood?
Well, say, for example, we keep that connection because my mother had 6 children, but Patty and I were always very close because, you know, to start with, she was the big sister. And my mother really couldn't, there were just too many children. She couldn't look after them. And a sort of rather, I don't know, husband that wasn't actually that great and had his eyes on other women. So Patty and I stayed very close. And so, say for example, nowadays we do Pilates together. So it's the studio where you just have two people at a time, and so she and I every week do that, and then we're going to have lunch afterwards next door. And and I'll see her on Wednesday. So we stay very close.
It's great to have
Because we
routines
have
like
so many
that.
memories, sort of you could cry, you could laugh, you could, just there's so many memories.
In the time between marriages, Mick got a girlfriend whose name was Ginny. Interesting. Quote, after Mick stopped seeing Ginny, I'm sorry, that's so weird to me.
Yep.
I'm a little confused. Ginny, Jenny. Okay. Ginny, Jenny for the listeners. Mick asked me if I would drive up the coast with the children and stay with him at the record plant, the studio in Sausalito, California, where Rumors was recorded, very famous place. He wanted to see if we could patch things up. I was used to being in the studio while they were recording, and it was as if none of the events of the past few months had happened. We slipped back into a lifestyle we knew well. However, we were still unable to talk to each other about our relationship, and neither of us had changed. We both wanted our marriage to work, but we didn't know how to make that happen. Despite this, we decided to try again. There were no rules in our relationship, and the fact that the divorce proceedings were underway or had now been finalized didn't mean a thing. There were times when Mick and I regained a sense of closeness, similar to when we were young and naive, talking and laughing with each other, remembering funny little things. Him telling me his plans for building a studio in the house, me chatting about the girls, and on occasion, I believed we would always be together. But they were so fleeting, lasting a day or two at the most, and then he'd slipped back into not coming home at night and disappearing into a place that I could never reach. I wanted to pull back a little bit and comment on Jenny and Mick divorcing and then remarrying. That's not an easy choice to make to, start fresh with someone. And they started anew like a few times in their relationship, briefly dating and breaking up and dating and breaking up again in the 60s, and then being married for this longer stretch of time, and then separating and getting married again. Like this capacity to always want to start new and like explore a new facet, a new evolution of their relationship is something I really admire about Jenny. Sort of this willingness to try again from a different place. That's one of my favorite things about
Yeah.
her reading her book.
I wonder whether because she came from a kind of broken family with like several stepdads and remarriage and half siblings, whether she just wanted this to work so badly for her children. And
Right, it's
yes,
stability.
and I also she comes back and makes a point in her book to say a couple of times that Mick was her first true love, and she always tried to come back to that feeling that she felt with him when they were together for the first time.
In the summer of 1976, Mick told Jenny that he and his parents had decided that she was no longer to see their children. She was heartbroken and flew back to England. Mick called her from the road from time to time, but he always told her not to call the children. Jenny missed them deeply, especially as she tried to fall asleep at night. As her month in England was coming to an end, she found the strength and will to start a new life with Mick again. She felt like ultimately they both wanted it to work, and so one day she called him to tell him she was ready. Fly to Philadelphia, he said. You can join up with the tour. Tour life was busy, as always, but for a while, things seemed to be working out between the two. After a short European promotional tour, it was brought to Fleetwood Mac's attention that the British members of the band would all need green cards if they wanted to live and work in the United States. The normally lengthy process of application could be shortened by a good word from a politician. That word was easily offered, and returned for the group's promise to play a fundraising concert the following year. But there was another problem. In order for the children and Jenny to be included in the green card package, Mick and her needed to be husband and wife. A ceremony was quickly convened in the office of band lawyer Mickey Shapiro. Lindsay was our best man, and Amelia and Lucy, our supporters, Always the optimist, I hoped the second marriage, even though I knew it was forced upon us, would bring us closer together. But nothing really seemed to change, and they soon fell back into their old patterns.
Mick and Jenny struggled on, but the trust between them was badly frayed. What came next didn't help. By 1975, Fleetwood Mac had its big breakthrough. The band's new lineup, with Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joining, achieved huge success. With fame came new temptations. Mick's own infidelity soon eclipsed Jenny's brief transgressions. Most infamously, Mick had an affair with Stevie Nicks around 1977. The romantic entanglements within Fleetwood Mac were the stuff of rock legends. Stevie and Lindsey's relationship was falling apart. Stevie was also involved with the Eagles drummer Don Henley, and in the midst of all of that, she and Mick fell into a clandestine fling. When Jenny learned of Mick and Stevie's liaison, it was devastating. She later admitted that for years she refused to speak to Stevie Nicks out of hurt and anger. That betrayal was the final blow to their marriage. In 1976, Jenny and Mick divorced. Bound by history, children, and a shared sense that they had grown up together, they drifted back toward one another. By 1978, Jenny had endured enough. She and Mick divorced for the second and final time. The 8-year marriage had seen incredible highs and devastating lows, leaving Jenny emotionally drained and, in her own words, feeling a total loss of identity. She later summed up life as a rock star's wife starkly: "It's not what you think." In the aftermath, Jenny attempted to find stability. In 1984, hoping perhaps that lightning wouldn't strike twice, she married another drummer, Ian Wallace, formerly of King Crimson. But that marriage also struggled and ultimately ended in divorce a few years later. Jenny realized that some of the same patterns of poor communication and her own lingering emotional wounds were repeating. It was a signal that she needed to step back and truly heal herself.
Having moved around and visited so many places, where's home? What feels like home to you?
I don't have one.
Really?
Yeah. It's a question I often ask myself. I don't know. Yeah.
So,
because we lived in LA for, well, those 5 years to begin with, then 5 years back in England, and then 10 years in LA, and moving around sort of there too. But I go back to LA sort of every, usually about a couple of times a year. Yeah, once or twice. So I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever know. Maybe.
So do you find a little bit of home in everywhere you are? Or do you make that yourself?
Well, it was easier to recognize home when my kids were smaller and we moved over from LA. We moved to England, to Surrey, where it was, they went to this sweet little school. I was there. We were there for about 4 years and had a little cottage. And their little friends would come and visit. And so that felt like home. I suppose probably because the kids were young. And it was very sort of homey. And then other place, when I moved over back to LA, I was always feeling we'd be moving soon. I never felt I was like completely there. But maybe it'll happen still. I don't know. I'll find somewhere.
Another beautiful chapter.
And I wonder whether, because I know other friends of mine who've been, even in their young years, have lived in different countries. Like, you know, my formative years were in Africa and then England. And then, you know, so maybe you just never have a sense of home. I don't know.
By her mid-30s, Jenny Boyd had lived several lifetimes worth of adventure. Model, boutique owner, rock wife, muse, but she still hadn't found Jenny, the independent person. In the early 1980s, newly single and determined to break her cycle of dependency and substance use, Jenny made a bold decision. She would start over and pursue the education she had bypassed in her youth. In 1985, at age 37, Jenny moved to California and enrolled at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, as a psychology student. It was an unlikely sight, a former 60s it girl sitting in a classroom with 20-year-olds, and it wasn't easy. Jenny had to overcome self-doubt about returning to school later in life, but she found that her unique experiences actually drove her passion for psychology. She was always a deep thinker and had long been fascinated by questions of creativity and spirituality. Jenny thrived in academia. She went on to earn a PhD in psychology in the late 1980s, formally becoming Dr. Jenny Boyd. She worked in the field of addiction and recovery, something very close to her, who eventually lost who eventually lost her life to addiction. She had lived with Mick, an alcoholic, and had been surrounded by many musicians who had been struggling with substance abuse, so this field felt especially close to her. She eventually became the clinical manager of an addiction treatment clinic in England. This work was deeply meaningful to her, perhaps informed by everything she'd seen and endured during the wild rock and roll years.
You've expressed you're such an independent person, and we're certainly quite free-spirited through the events of these books. I find a very difficult lesson to learn as a woman is sort of how to advocate for yourself. How did you learn to do so?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm still learning in many ways. That's a really tricky one sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think for women, I know for me, my mother was very much, you know, it's a man's world and men sort of have higher ground. And so it's not that easy when you've had all that dinned into you. Although, you know, when I was younger, that was fine, quite easy. But I think that's a tricky question because, I mean, I know after I'd been modeling and after the children had grown up, then I worked in the addiction field for about 20 years. And that was definitely my thing. And, you know, working, getting people into treatment from England, then into Tucson. And I spent a lot of time getting the psychiatrist and the therapist to come over to England and then bringing the ones over in England to the treatment center. So that was definitely my thing. And as a woman, that was fine.
Right. That was a portion of your book that really moved me, sort of talking about that chapter in your life. How has your perspective on addiction changed since working in the recovery field?
I don't think it's changed. I think I was on a mission without realizing it. And whether it had anything to do with our sister who was an addict, and I managed to get her into treatment, but she'd been in lots of different treatment centers. I think, you know, and I'd been surrounded by everybody that drank earlier on, you know, when I was living in LA. And so I think, I don't think it was a sort of penance, but I used to think, is it? But I really enjoyed it because the whole thing to do with getting into treatment, the 12-step program, is very spiritual. And my, I suppose, place that I've always come from and part of is very much interested in the sort of spiritual world. And I think that, you know, I'd do the assessments beforehand and it'd be quite difficult because people would have to say how much they were drinking or how much they were using. But then I'd do the aftercare group afterwards when they'd actually been through treatment. And it was amazing, you know, and you'd see them completely, they found a renewal in their life and had a, you know, and had a sort of spiritual awareness. So I suppose it all kind of mixed up together.
Yes, and
if there's any one thing you'd want an outsider, someone who's been very fortunate never to have experienced addiction within their family or with a loved one or themselves, is there any one thing you'd want an outsider to know? What would that thing be?
Ooh, that has nothing to do with addiction, but do they need to know anything about addiction or who would this outsider be?
Well, I guess it sort of comes from a place of having empathy for people who have struggles maybe they can't visualize themselves in.
Yeah. Yep. There's an awful lot bound up in that because, you know, a lot of addicts are very compulsive. So there's that. But that's a really tricky question, really. I don't think there's anybody who has had no, lived a life without any kind of obsessiveness. Because that's what it is, isn't it? It's about being obsessive. You can't have enough drink. You can't have enough, you know, you just can't get enough.
Right.
But there's some people, and that's why that was the difference, you know, with the 12-step program, they believed it was a disease. I don't know if everybody believes that. I mean, when our, because our sister finally died, our youngest sister, as you know in the book, but so she had this very obsessive part of her that was stronger than her. And I don't know how one would explain that.
It was a chapter in your book that really resonated me. So I want to thank you for sort of writing about all of that, because it can't have been an easy thing to do.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Another big chapter of your writing to sort of pivot was revolving around going back to school and earning your doctorate. First of all, I know it's several decades overdue, but congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you find it difficult to go back to school in adulthood?
Well, yes. And I'll tell you why, because I'd only been surrounded by musicians. I didn't know normal people, you know. And so it was like coming out of your kind of bubble, musician bubble, and being with people who aren't musicians. And I was so nervous, but not only that, I didn't have the courage really to say, I'm doing something for myself now. You know, this was when I was with husband number two, Ian Wallace, drummer Ian Wallace, because I'd always be there to go on the road and do this and do that and go to someone's wedding. And now I was putting myself first, and it felt very uncomfortable to begin with. And then the very first day that I attended one of the classes, and everybody around the table had to say who they were, what it was they wanted to get out of this, and, you know, that kind of thing. And I could see it getting closer and closer to me. And because I have an English accent, I was very aware of that. And as it got closer, I could feel myself spinning. And then I had to put my hand up, and I was trying to say, I think I'm going to faint. And I did faint.
Oh, no.
Because I was so anxious. It was, I was really challenging myself to such a degree. And so after not wanting to be noticed, suddenly I was like, full attention was on me. They were trying to get me up. And so that was my first day. So it was a big thing to do. But I then loved it. I loved working together. I loved, you know, the different courses and the psychology classes. And it was just heaven.
It's something that resonated very deeply with me in your book, because I am at the stage in life where you were before that. I have little kids and I did not go to university yet. And it's something that I'm kind of so excited for, but on the other hand, also a little nervous, because I feel like once I will attend university, I'll be in my early 30s most likely. So that's going to be nervous, but it was so encouraging reading about that in your book, and also that you pursued education so far that you got a doctorate. That is something I admire that very much.
Yes, thank you so much. I think once you get the bug and you're not like beholden to the husband and having to do everything that they say, you actually find your own voice, because that's what it is. It feels inspiring. And then I didn't want to stop.
For her doctoral research, Jenny chose to explore the creative process of musicians, essentially merging her two worlds, music and psychology. She conducted in-depth interviews with 75 well-known musicians about how inspiration struck and what fueled their creativity. The list of interviewees was a who's who of music. She spoke with George Harrison, her ex-brother-in-law, Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, her other ex-brother-in-law, Joni Mitchell, Don Henley, Ravi Shankar, and many others. Her work was published under the title Musicians in Tune. Jenny presented these artists' insights into creativity, often relating their experiences to psychological concepts like Abraham Maslow's peak experiences. For instance, she wanted to know if musicians ever felt as though songs came to them from a higher source. The conversations were illuminating. She learned, for example, that many of the successful musicians, from an ex-Beatle to blues legend B.B. King, shared a kind of humility about their art, and often described a spiritual quality to their best creative moments.
And you were
inspired once again by music carrying through your studies, you first entered the publishing world, not with this memoir, Jennifer Juniper, but with your thesis, Musicians in Tune. What was the writing process like?
Well, I felt I was starting from scratch. I mean, when I first joined the college, I was put on a sort of, we're only going to try you for 3 months and see how you do, because I didn't know about senior papers. I didn't know anything. And but I did have the support of one of the doctors there, Dr. Ron Alexander. And that was enough to kind of get me through and believe I can do, you know, papers and writing and this and that. But the reason why I chose that for my doctorate was because I thought, well, I've never felt I'm creative. And yet, you know, I've been sitting on the roof of the ashram, listening and watching the Beatles kind of do their writing their songs and things, and watched, you know, Fleetwood Mac writing their songs. And in fact, two of my poems became their, you know, they had that as their one of their records. And I just thought, well, I don't feel creative, so I bet you a ton of people don't feel creative. And also, musicians up until that time represented, you know, getting out of it and drinking and tooting and doing all that stuff to stay awake, whether it's for the album, doing an album or whatever it was. So they represented that to me. But once I started interviewing, they had this spiritual place, you know, they had this amazing, you know, just because I think the whole thing about creativity and self-expression is very spiritual. And so it was very inspiring, every single interview. And I felt that we were getting, because I'd learned how to, you know, because I'd got my master's in counseling psychology, I knew when to keep quiet. So they'd carry on and go a bit deeper. And so, you know, pretty much everyone I interviewed said, "Oof, I've never had an interview like that before. That was like therapy." Mm-hmm. But it was very inspiring.
There's like 70-something interviews in the original.
75. Yes.
In the original Musicians
in Tune. In the original one. And then came out in America and in Japan. Then when I moved to England, I sort of had a little look around, see if anybody would like to publish it there. And they did. I sort of did tiny edits, but not much. And then that came out as It's Not Only Rock and Roll. But then recently, I was asked by another publishers to redo it. And by this time, instead of it being a psychological work, I did it just with, okay, these are the questions I asked, these are the answers I got. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot more in this third book, which is Icons of Rock in Their Own Words.
Yes.
A lot more, like all of the Joni Mitchell tape, all of the George Harrison tape, I got a lot more of that side, and it wasn't so psychological.
Writing Musicians in Tune was cathartic for Jenny. It also helped heal old wounds. As part of the project, she interviewed Mick about his creative process. In those interviews and conversations long after the dust had settled, Mick and Jenny finally talked openly about the pain they'd caused each other. Mick was stunned to learn how isolated and unhappy Jenny had been in their marriage. In time, Mick and Jenny rebuilt a friendship out of the ashes of their past. Mick even asked Jenny for help with writing his own memoir because he admitted he'd forgotten so many things. When Jenny published her memoir, Mick publicly endorsed it, even if parts of it were too hard for him to read.
The early 1990s thus marked a rebirth for Jenny Boyd, not as a muse or a rock wife, but as an author, psychologist, and independent woman. And life had one more happy surprise in store. In 1997, Jenny married again, this time to someone far outside the music business, an architect named David Levitt. Finally, Jenny has found a lasting, peaceful partnership. As of today, she and David have been married for nearly 30 years.
I love that both Patty and Jenny, after both marrying two musicians, have found their Prince Charming with the third husband, and he's a normal guy.
Yes.
Both of their husbands are just regular schmegular guys, and I love that for the both of them.
Me too, but can you imagine dating them? I would be so intimidated.
Well, yeah, Patty's husband was like a fan of hers.
Yes.
That's when so he was cool. Young, so he was like so nervous around her.
I love that. That's so
sweet. Very sweet.
What was it like revisiting that work after 30 years, sort of
with this new perspective? Incredible. I'd listen to the audio tapes, you know, say Joni Mitchell and her, just it's just so timeless. But I did do something I have to admit, and I hate admitting it, is that the cassette tapes that, you know, they take up a lot of room. And I was moving around and I'd left LA because when I was in LA, I had them in a bank vault. And then I was moving around in England, different places, and I was so nervous that someone might steal them or, you know, they could get lost or something like that. And I'd been trusted. And some of the things that were said in those audio tapes, they would not have liked to be sort of bandied around.
Right.
So, and I didn't want to trust anybody as time went on because, you know, this was quite a number of years I was moving them around. I didn't want to trust anybody to make it into like an MP3 so that it's, so what I did, I tore up the cassette tapes, every single one except for 7. So I kept, which I knew I'd be able to look after. I kept the Joni Mitchell, I kept the George Harrison, Ringo, Don Henley, Graham Nash, Ravi Shankar, and a really great jazz drummer, Steve Jordan. Mm. So I kept those 7, and those are the ones that I then transcribed.
Emma, hearing Graham Nash mentioned just like immediately made me think of you.
Yeah.
Of these tapes that you amassed, was there an interview that really shaped where the project would go, that really changed your perspective?
Well, many of them changed my perspective. And I thought I had a great interview with Don Henley, and he was so, because I'd known Don, because my husband Ian would go out on the road with him. So I'd often be on the road and knew him, but I hadn't ever just spoken to him and me, like me interviewing him. And that was a, I thought, great interview. And very aware. But I think pretty much all of them, they all had their own thing. George Harrison, you know, that was lovely because he was like, he was my brother-in-law. And, you know, how he'd say, we never, never knew that the Beatles would be so huge. We never had any idea. And, you know, so you get them when they're sort of looking back on their life and how things came about.
Alongside writing, Jenny continued working in addiction recovery for many years. She served as the manager of an addiction treatment center in London, applying her experience and empathy to help people rebuild their lives. This work gave Jenny her sense of purpose, beyond the glamour of her past. Jenny has observed how her perspective on addiction evolved over time, seeing it from both the personal and professional side.
In 2020, at age 72, Jenny Boyd added another achievement to her resume. She became a memoirist. She published Jennifer Junifer, A Journey Beyond the Muse, her autobiography. The title itself was a statement, Beyond the Muse. Jenny was well aware that, to many, she was a footnote in someone else's tale, the inspiration for a Donovan song, the sister of a famous model, the wife of a rock star. With her memoir, she asserted her identity beyond those labels.
And I was wondering, after you've been with all these musicians and all these circles and everyone always was so famous around you, how did it feel opening up about your own life for your book? Because I feel like, did you ever felt like your story wasn't as interesting as the stories around you? Because there were all these larger than life figures. And I can only imagine that being a little intimidating.
Well, I think it took me a while to actually build up the courage to write it. To begin with, I began doing a sort of a kind of fictitious version, faintly disguised. Mm-hmm. And then someone said to me, for God's sake, you know, just write your memoir. And so I think I knew Mick would be okay because he'd asked for help with one of his memoirs. And because he'd forgotten like an awful lot of stuff. So I did give him quite a bit of my stuff. But I didn't want to I had to be very careful in a way, because I didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but I think I knew I wasn't going to say anything horrid about anybody, but it was difficult with Mick because that was my journey. But I knew that he knew that because, you know, he'd obviously seen it. But he also said he didn't know that I was going through what I was going through because he was sort of very much drinking and using and all that stuff. But I felt that if I keep to my side, my vision, how I felt about things, that I was safe because it was like nobody else has that point of view that I have.
Writing so much about musicians, was it difficult to transition to writing about yourself?
No, because I'd read things that Mick had said, you know, say for Rolling Stone magazine, and I'd think, that's not right. You know, he's got it completely wrong. Mm. And so there's a part of me that wanted to tell my story, like, this is the truth, you know, this is what it was, this is what it was like. So I think there was a real compulsion. And even though it took me a while to get published, I couldn't let it go. Right. You know, it's like, no, it's almost like this had to be written.
Jenny has lived so many lives, but she told us a little secret. She's about to add another project to her resume.
I've written my first novel.
Wow. Oh, wow. This is news to me.
Not yet. I've just finished it. I've completed it. My agent's got it. I've just got to do, you know, a little bio, you know, but that's been a labor of love. And I've never done a novel before. Whether it becomes a book or not, I don't know, but it would be great if it did. So that's been really, really inspiring and full on.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. We are hoping for the best for this novel. Do you have anything else going on? Any talks coming up? Anything?
Yeah, no talks coming up. I did one in Chicago in August, which was the Beatle Festival, and that's really fun. And it's a whole weekend, and they kind of, you just take over the whole hotel, and there's like Beatle stuff everywhere, and it's like going back to the 60s. And I did a few talks in bookshops in LA and around LA last year. And then I did a New York Beatle Festival. So and I love giving the talks, but it's fun to share stuff. But I used to be terrified of actually standing up and speaking, and now I love it.
I just have one more question. Now that we heard about that novel, I'm immediately and I was wondering if there's like a little something you can tell us about that yet?
Yes. Okay, so it is musician based. I mean, you know, rock and roll. And it's something that happens. I don't know if I should tell you anything. Something that happens that's really drastic and really terrifying. And it stops the protagonist, who actually, this does actually happen. And it belonged to her ex-husband. She saw something awful. And her memory went completely for 20, just over 20 something years. And so it's a story how it's recouped, and nobody ever heard any more about this musician, this who was her husband. So it's got, I'm having to do now, just actually doing like give a synopsis, and I think, and why did you write it, sort of those kind of questions. And I think that I've used parts of my life, but then played around with it, with the information and the feelings and stuff. So it's been something I've never experienced before. But for the last year and a half, however long it's been taking me, I've been feel like I'm living two different lives. It's very sort of skitsy because I've got my life here, but then I've got this other life, this other world that I'm sort of creating, and that's become very real, and the characters have been very real. And it'll be quite a relief to finish it.
Well, we'll be excitedly waiting for that.
Yeah, let's see. So I think my agent gets it in a couple of weeks when I've written all the different, you know, and found a photograph. And then she'll start moving it around. So we'll see. It would be fun.
As we wrap up Jenny's incredible life story, we're lucky to have her with us to share her own insight. After everything, the music, the madness, the searching, how does Jenny Boyd feel about the idea of being a muse? We'll let her have the last word on that.
I don't think about it. But how did I? No, I think I was just really taken by the song. And Donovan was so sweet. But, you know, I wasn't sort of thinking, oh, yes, we can be boyfriend and girlfriend, anything like that. But it was more just, I felt honored in a way. And over the years, you know, that sort of song, if I ever hear it in an elevator or in a, I don't know, shopping mall or anything like that, it just reminds me of such an innocent time. I don't think, oh, I'm a muse. Even though that's why with my book, I put a journey beyond the muse. So it's not just that, it's like beyond.
Because in a sense, it feels like having written a song about you is something so personal and something so special. It's something that I feel like a lot of people never get to experience. So it seems like something, yes, just very special.
Very special. Yeah. And it's lovely. It's a sweet song. And I know, you know, people who call their daughters Juniper or, you know, it's affected a lot of people in different ways.
Thanks for tuning in to the season 3 premiere of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. And another big thank you for Jenny Boyd for being our guest. We hope you listeners enjoyed our journey through the life of Jenny Boyd, the journey beyond the muse.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. We definitely took a hit to our ratings after I published 2 episodes on Yoko Ono, but like I joked, our rating was just too good. We needed to average it out a little bit. Your feedback does mean the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.